The Poet and the CEO. When Sam was done, a thin, morose young man named Terry Wright, a poet who'd never eaten half so well in all his life as on this trip, although his manner didn't show it, coughed to indicate that he had something to relate. But when the others looked at him, they saw with some dismay that his white shirt was gray and that his cuffs showed fray. Why was he on the ship? Because the young astronomer, whose name was Rip, had wanted it that way. "I'm off to Crow," said Wright, "but not on some evangelizing mission or to reap a monetary gain. No, my reason's plain. I'm simply tired of the earth. Little do I see in nature that is worth what it was worth the moment of my birth. I've lived but 80 years, and yet I know where'er I go that there have passed away 1,000 glories from the earth." Unlike our uncle, Wordsworth, did my generation come trailing clouds of smoke from hell, which is our womb. And so I'm on my way to Crow to find a better world, or find a tomb. At this upspoke the CEO, whose name was Arnold Robb. Said he, "I have a son called Bob who is, like you, just 80 Wait, I think, oh hell, I'd have to say the kid is 80 years and 3 if he's a day. Bob owns a Harley and an SUV, and you can bet I've never heard him whine. He doesn't lie around and pine for what he thinks he cannot get. He spends his time at futures trading on the Internet. My boy, you should be more like Bob. Get on the net or find a job." And then he laughed. "Perhaps you've never noticed the condition of your pants and shirt, or do you fear dry cleaning them would set off an ozone alert?" Replied the youth, "A wise man gave me some advice. He was a banker by profession. I met him at a time when I was under the impression I could get a bank loan and thus better my condition. But my collateral was text. The man did not show me the door or tell his secretary whom to send in next. He carefully explained to me, if there be rich, there must be poor, just like, if there be hot, there must be cold, if peace, then war, if bought, then sold. So though he turned down my appeal, I didn't feel he'd given me the boot. He made me see a man can serve a social purpose higher than his poesy just by being destitute. I felt he really gave a hoot." And then this banker turned, picked up his ringing phone, and maybe just to prove to me his absolute consistency and strict impartiality, he gave a guy he'd never met a $1 million loan. The poet smiled. "Who knows, old boy," he told the CEO. "Perhaps when this strange trip is done, by which time I'll be 21, I'll go back home and follow your advice. I'll sacrifice my melancholy and my theme. I'll put aside my dream of meadow, grove, and stream apparelled in celestial light. And then, like you and Sonny, I'll occupy myself with money, learn where money comes from, where it goes, why it stagnates, where it flows, why it devalues, how it grows. And once I know, I'll write a story about money, using New York Times official prose, or find some even drier way to tell it. And then I'll hold my nose and try to sell it." When Terry Wright was done, it wasn't clear if he'd been serious or cavalier. Before one delegate could think of what to say, word came that caviar was being served up in the dining bay. Not because the poet was a bore was everyone so keen to dash. They simply wished to eat some more. But there, oh dear, was Lash, still velcroed to the floor. A member of the crew was called to undo the disaster. He grabbed the poor croc by the tail, and faster than the eye could see, gave one quick tug that ripped Lash off the rug like an adhesive plaster. Without a pause, the crewman flipped him, stripped him of the band of Velcro lining him from snout to tush, gave the croc a little push, at which, to everyone's relief, Lash floated toward his crocodile, who reached out with a loving smile and drew him near. And there the two crocs clung and kissed, and never knew what meals they missed.